This is the CBS News Year-End Roundup, with background and analysis from the correspondents who cover the news. And now, here's national correspondent Dan Raviv.
2007 was a year of transition. This past March was the fourth anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. In a moment, CBS's David Martin on how the war has changed this year. Later, we'll talk about politics, a new president to be elected in 08, but that process took up much of 07. Also ahead, dangerous lead in toys and food contamination, part of a congressional hearing.
The American people truly believe that the government is there to protect them. But I'm here to tell them that is not the fact.
And we'll report on gun violence, a massacre at a Nebraska shopping mall in December, and at a college in April, CBS's Frank Settapani.
A deranged Virginia Tech gunman would kill two fellow students in a dormitory. Sungwi Jo would return to campus 2 hours later to kill 30 more students and professors before taking his own life.
More ahead on that, and Steve Futterman will tell us about the Southern California wildfires he saw, felt, and smelled.
It was a deadly combination of wind and fire. And for 1 week in late October, it seemed that much of Southern California was ablaze.
Leave the area immediately.
And a lot more ahead. But first, let's take the pulse of the nation with CBS News Chief Washington Correspondent Bob Schieffer, who feels one of many problems with which President Bush has had to contend is a sour mood in the country.
Yes, and I mean, every poll you look at suggests that. A substantial majority of people feel the country is headed in the wrong direction.
So with Mr. Bush's approval rating so low, will the Republican candidate, whoever that turns out to be, have to distance himself from George W. Bush?
Well, he may. I mean, and we'll find out in the coming months. A lot of that, I think, will depend on what the economy, what shape the economy is as we come toward the general election, and also where things stand in Iraq. Right now, Iraq is pretty good from a political standpoint in that the violence is no question it's down. But that cannot stay that way. I mean, the worst thing in the world you can ever do is predict events in the Middle East.
That's Bob Schieffer, host of Face the Nation on CBS on Sundays. Let's turn to CBS News national security correspondent David Martin at the Pentagon. Of course, President Bush sent more troops to Iraq this year, and that surge is scheduled to end probably in the first half of 2008. David, if the war is going better, how much better?
Well, there are any number of statistics you can use, but the one that probably has the most resonance in the United States is that the number of soldiers killed in combat has gone down dramatically. In May of this year, 120 soldiers and Marines were killed. In November of this year, it was just 28 killed in combat. The other measure is the overall level of violence. That includes attacks on civilians in Iraq. And that is down, according to the commander in Iraq, General David Petraeus, down 60%. So I don't think there's any argument over the fact that the troop surge combined with and thanks to the conversion of so many of the Sunni tribes away from al-Qaeda in Iraq and over to the American side, which really amounts to something like 60,000 additional soldiers fighting on our side as opposed to against us, has produced a dramatic decrease in violence. The question is, will it last?
Another question might be, will Iraqi politicians take advantage of the improved security? When President Bush talked about the surge and his motivation, he thought it would give that opening to Iraqi politicians. They haven't done much.
Well, that's another way of asking the will it last question. The Iraqis have to come up with a way of governing themselves, and that means governing the Shiites, the Sunnis, and the Kurds within a national government. And their parliament simply cannot pass, or has so far been unable to pass, all of the so-called reconciliation laws that would bring about a national government. The politics of it are pretty simple. The Shiites dominate the national government. The Sunnis have made the biggest difference in the level of violence by coming over to the American side. But if the Sunnis keep looking at this and say, hey, there's nothing in this for us, because the Shiites simply aren't making any political compromises, despite all we've done to bring down the level of violence, then this probably does not have a very promising future.
The Shiite Muslims being the majority there. Well, the U.S. is committed to cutting its troop strength in the coming year. Only in March will there be a major review of troop strength, how things are going. What's the chance that, well, that things might be going so poorly or slowly that the U.S. actually can't wind down its presence in Iraq in 08?
Well, I think you will see, at a minimum, the reduction of the current force of 20 combat brigades down to 15 combat brigades. And that is simply a factor of the deployment schedules. And the Army is just maxed out and cannot sustain a force of 20 combat brigades in Iraq.
It's been just over a year now since Robert Gates took over as Secretary of Defense, replacing Donald Rumsfeld. Has Gates made a lot of changes?
Oh, yes. It's night and day. He had this one enormous advantage. He didn't have to defend any of the decisions that were made before. He could come into this thing with an absolute clean slate. And he has taken advantage of that to really take a fresh look at the entire strategy. And, of course, at the same time, there's been a change in commanders. And you now have General David Petraeus in command in Iraq, the sort of godfather of the American military's counterinsurgency doctrine. Gates gives much more respect and deference to the combat commanders than Rumsfeld did.
At the Pentagon, CBS News national security correspondent David Martin. Thanks, David, and Happy New Year.
Thank you.
Now, notable deaths this year. Obituaries by correspondent Bill Whitney.
If ever I would leave you.
Singer Robert Goulet left us in 2007, along with other musical greats, Luciano Pavarotti, Frankie Lane, Lee Hazelwood, and Max Roach. The film world mourned Ingmar Bergman, Deborah Carr, Jane Wyman.
Hi, it's Anna Nicole.
Anna Nicole Smith died too young. Tom Snyder will never laugh again.
Holy cow, he did!
This was the year Phil Rizzuto's microphone went silent, and racehorse Barbaro finally died of his injuries. Readers lost Norman Mailer, Kurt Vonnegut, and Art Buchwald. While prayers were said for televangelists Tammy Faye Messner and Jerry Falwell.
I was always at the periphery.
Former First Lady Lady Bird Johnson bid us farewell. Finally, let us pause to remember our servicemen killed in Afghanistan and Iraq. Too many to name, each too important to forget. Bill Whitney, CBS News.
In a few moments, our executive producer, Howard Arenstein, on this year's top stories.
Stay with us. The CBS News Year-End Roundup will be right back. This is the CBS News Year-End Roundup.
This is Howard Arenstein. Our vote for the story of 2007, the economy. Here's correspondent Dan Revive.
Did you realize how much our economy, our sense of wealth and well-being, depends on believing that our homes, our biggest investment, will just keep rising in value?
We've reduced the price of the house over $100,000.
Just one voice in a crowd of dismayed homeowners, unable to sell, certainly not at the price they hoped for.
Definitely slowing down. More homes on the market, less buyers.
A realtor in Southern California, Jill Strzok, in an area, one of many, where confidence was shattered this year.
They are worried that if they buy a house for a certain amount today, that tomorrow it will decrease in value.
A huge psychological change. The big home building companies went from high profits to bottomless losses. And listen to Ben Bernanke, the chair of the Federal Reserve Board.
Further sharp contraction in residential construction seemed likely to hold down overall economic growth.
So Bernanke tried to change the psychology. Top story on CBS, September 18th.
Tonight, help is on the way. The Fed cuts interest rates for the first time in 4 years.
But economist Mark Zandi commented,
I think we'll need a series of rate cuts to support confidence sufficiently to ensure this economy doesn't unravel into recession.
The Bush administration offered to insure some refinances and arranged a freeze in interest rates for borrowers who can't pay when adjustable rates jump upward. But the president in late August declared,
it's not the government's job to bail out speculators or those who made the decision to buy a home they knew they could never afford.
Let's turn to Jim Cramer, host of Mad Money on CNBC. Is a house still our best investment?
No, that's changed. it's changed because they built too many of them, and it's going to take 3 to 4 years to work off the inventory, which is a situation which just says, if you want to buy a house, buy it because you want to live in it. Do not expect appreciation. You'll probably not get any.
And do you expect a lot more foreclosures, failed mortgages?
I think we're in inning one of the foreclosures. I spent a lot of time monitoring the portfolios. October was the worst month we've had since the Great Depression.
So overall, we will remember this year as maybe one of the worst.
Worst since 1990, which was a year when almost every savings and loan closed. And I'm looking for a very similar situation to happen next year.
Jim Cramer saying banks and other financial institutions went too far in turning mortgages into investment vehicles. They packaged the loans and sold them practically like bonds in the belief that house values would never fall and almost all mortgage payments would be made like clockwork. The clock stopped. No wonder a lot of investors got nauseous from the Wall Street roller coaster. In a typical year, there are only 3 or 4 days when stocks go up or down by 2% or more. This year, that happened more than 20 times. That's called volatility, signaling nervousness about corporate profits at a time when it's hard for companies, just like citizens, to borrow, says Dean Baker at the Center for Economic and Policy Research.
We're going to see this credit crunch, a lot of people will really be constrained, and it's almost inevitable we will see a significant fall off in consumption, and that's going to have a serious impact on the economy.
And Clyde Prestowitz at the Economic Strategy Institute, how bad is the economy?
I think it's pretty bad. I think a lot of the chickens are coming home to roost. You know, the dollar has been riding for a fall for a long time, and so finally it's falling, and everything's kind of happening at once, so it's not a nice scene.
We see some adjustment. We hear, for instance, that some of the oil-producing countries are considering pricing their petroleum in euro, not dollars. Aside from being a slap at our pride, what's the difference?
Big difference. We are unique in that oil is priced in dollars. When other countries want to buy oil, they have to make something, so the Japanese have to make a Toyota and sell it to get dollars, and then they buy oil. All we have to do to buy oil is print dollars. If it's priced in euros, then suddenly we have to make something and sell it to the Europeans to get euros so that we can buy oil. That's a big shift.
The price of oil, whether it's in dollars, euro, or Saudi Arabian currency, has gone up a lot. We're not really cutting down our demand for oil. In other words, I'm not sure it's affected us in the U.S.
I think we haven't seen it yet, but these things happen with a lag.
We're likely to see a slower economy in the U.S., which means we'll all be a little bit poorer next year.
And not just in the U.S., but I think worldwide.
Somehow, most of us in the U.S. have gotten used to gassing up our cars at over $3 a gallon. That really adds up. On top of winter heating costs, one home fuel provider in New York, Danny Falcone.
You almost have to be a counselor to people because they have such a hard time dealing with the cost of energy today.
Many Americans now worry about the economy and wonder if solutions will sprout from the large crop of candidates running for president. Dan Revive, CBS News.
Seems like that large crop of candidates has been running for president forever. The political activity started more than a year ago, and this past year was filled with speeches and debates. Many, many debates. It was the earliest and most intensive presidential contest ever. And in some respects, it's just getting started. Here's White House correspondent Peter Mayer.
Campaign 08 really started in 07, the earliest kickoff in modern-day politics. The Iraq War was a big issue for Democrats Clinton, Edwards, and Obama.
We had known then what we know now. There never would have been a vote, and I never would have voted to give this president that authority.
I should never have voted for this war.
This is an enormous distraction from the battle that does have to be waged in Afghanistan and rooting out al-Qaeda.
On the Republican side, pro-abortion rights candidate Rudy Giuliani on Roe versus Wade.
It would be okay to repeal. It would be okay also if a strict constructionist judge viewed it as precedent.
John McCain campaigns on his resume.
I have seen war. I know how the military works. I know how the government works.
Mitt Romney has faced questions on his Mormon faith.
There are some pundits out there that are hoping that I'll distance myself from my church so that that'll help me politically. And that's not going to happen.
So many candidates, so many primaries. It all starts January 3rd in Iowa. Peter Mayer, CBS News.
2007 brought many stories of people getting sick from the food they ate. Here's correspondent Nick Young.
15-year-old Samantha Safranak didn't think much of it when she got sick after eating a hamburger.
I just thought it was some, like, virus that I had.
But she almost died from an E. coli infection, which appeared again when
Dole is recalling more of its bag salad.
There were also alarms over Chinese seafood.
The Food and Drug Administration today issued so-called import alerts for Chinese shrimp and eel, plus three types of fish.
And if that wasn't enough, some toothpaste was ordered off store shelves because
it may contain a poisonous chemical used in antifreeze.
Even cat and dog foods were pulled off shelves due to salmonella and melamine contamination. Critics charged the FDA with being lax on the job.
There's an old saying, the history of the FDA is written in tombstones.
Leading one congressman to declare,
who needs Al-Qaeda when you have E. coli?
In November, President Bush announced the FDA would be given authority to order recalls. Plus,
we will focus on stopping dangerous products from reaching our border in the first place.
Nick Young, CBS News.
Coming up, we continue to count down the top stories of 2007.
Stay with us on the CBS News Year-End Roundup. This is the CBS News Year-End Roundup.
As Americans went out to buy Christmas presents this year, they had more recalls to deal with than ever before. Here's correspondent Nick Young.
So what was the recall on?
With so many products coming off the shelves, at times it was hard to keep track.
The government today announced a major new recall of tainted toys.
Tonight, another massive recall. This time, a million cribs that can trap.
Of course, there was a lot of finger pointing. First to China.
What's wrong with American made?
It's a cheap labor is doing this country in.
But then manufacturers such as Mattel had to admit that China was not entirely to blame.
The vast majority of those products that were recalled were the result of a design flaw in Mattel's design.
Congress held hearings.
The American people truly believe that the government is there to protect them, especially from unsafe products. But I'm here to tell them that is not the fact.
But it was too late for Nikki Johns, whose son died from a faulty crib.
Unfortunately, it had to take a child's life for people to stand up and notice.
Nick Young, CBS News.
Back in the spring, Virginia Tech's campus was the scene of a horrific shooting that shocked the nation. Here's correspondent Frank Settapani.
On the morning of April 16th, no one in Blacksburg, Virginia could have imagined the horror that was about to unfold. A deranged Virginia Tech gunman would kill two fellow students in a dormitory. Sungwee Jo would return to campus 2 hours later to kill 30 more students and professors before taking his own life.
We had barricaded the door. Bullets were hitting the door and almost coming through the door.
Jo left a suicide video.
He forced me into a corner and gave me only one option.
School officials were criticized for not taking more effective action between the first and second attacks to minimize the bloodshed.
The information we had on the first incident led us to make the decision that it was an isolated event.
Jo had no criminal record, but he did have a history of mental illness.
Some students described his writings as, quote, twisted.
Somehow, Jo slipped through the cracks without treatment.
When the time came, I did it.
It was the deadliest school shooting the country had ever seen. Frank Settapani, CBS News.
In the fall, parts of California turned into an inferno. Here's correspondent Steve Futterman.
It was a deadly combination of wind and fire. And for 1 week in late October, it seemed that much of Southern California was ablaze.
Leave the area immediately. This is mandatory evacuation.
I told you to get out. You need to get out now.
More than a dozen fires raged out of control from north of Los Angeles to the Mexican border. Firefighters were overwhelmed. There were simply too many fires.
There's just no fire engines here. There are the flames, really big, big flames.
More than 400,000 acres burned. More than 2,000 homes were destroyed.
It was my home for 40 years, and now it's gone.
The battle took place on the ground and in the air. President Bush came to offer help.
We appreciate your spirit. Really do.
But in some cases, all people had left were the clothes they were wearing.
That's all we had time for. It came faster than we thought.
Steve Futterman, CBS News.
In the summer, a bridge collapsed in Minnesota, scaring drivers across the country. Correspondent Cammie McCormick has that story.
It happened without warning as commuters made their way home from work during the afternoon rush hour, August 1st.
They were all screaming, "We're going to go in the river, we're going to go in the river."
The Interstate 35 bridge collapsed. As cars plunged into the water, bystanders rushed to help, and then began the agonizing wait to find those still missing in the murky waters.
We've been to the hospitals, we've been to the police, we've been to the morgue.
The collapse sparked a nationwide inspection of bridges.
Bridges in America should not fall down.
And a closer look at the nation's infrastructure, not just bridges, but dams and levees. Have they been ignored for too long? States were quick to cite the cost of repairs and inspections.
We have to make those investments, and you either pay now or you pay a whole lot later.
In Minneapolis, the people prayed for the victims and rallied together to recover from a disaster they'd never forget. Cammie McCormick, CBS News.
Another disaster in August caught the country's attention. Here again, correspondent Steve Futterman.
A collapse at the Crandall Canyon mine in central Utah.
We are using every means known to mankind.
Six miners were trapped.
Every single family, you can feel the tension building up. Everyone's hoping for them to be okay.
Rescue workers desperately tried to locate the missing men.
Oh, I wish they could have heard a noise of any kind.
A week later, tragedy upon tragedy. Another collapse killed three of the rescue workers. Utah's governor led the mourning.
These men died as heroes.
As the days passed without any sign of life, officials began to concede the miners were likely dead. Some of the families expressed anger.
We feel that they've given up and that they're just waiting for the six miners to expire.
In the end, the Crandall mine was sealed. The bodies were never recovered.
I would like to know where my son is in that hole so I can leave a marker on the mount.
Steve Futterman, CBS News.
And for yet another year, the war in Iraq remained among the top stories. This time, though, with a sharp drop in violence there. Again, here's correspondent Cammie McCormick.
The year began with an announcement by President Bush of a troop surge in Iraq.
I've committed more than 20,000 additional American troops to Iraq. The vast majority of them will be deployed to Baghdad.
Tours were extended for soldiers and Marines already on the ground to 15 months. The president hinted it was the last best hope.
The changes are aimed at ensuring the survival of a young democracy that is fighting for its life in a part of the world of enormous importance to American security.
There was a new commander in Iraq, General Dave Petraeus, who was called before Congress to convince skeptical lawmakers the plan was working.
With all due respect to you, I must say I don't buy it.
But then the violence dropped sharply. The success of the surge, commanders hope so, General Carter Ham.
There has been much momentum, but it's not yet irreversible.
Despite successes, 2007 was the deadliest yet for U.S. troops in Iraq. Cammie McCormick, CBS News.
By the end of the year, the use of performance-enhancing drugs brought shame to the national pastime. Correspondent Dave Barrett looks at the sports scandals of 2007.
He hit home run 756 to pass Henry Aaron. Barry Bonds insisted.
This record is not tainted.
Not in his mind.
Period.
Bonds was indicted. Feds say he lied to a grand jury about steroids.
The use of steroids in Major League Baseball was widespread.
The Mitchell report came out. 85 players, including Roger Clemens, were named. The commissioner said.
This is not something that I wish had happened. But it had, and I have to face it.
One of the recommendations.
Year-round, unannounced testing.
Sprinter Marion Jones always insisted.
I have never, ever used performance-enhancing drugs.
But she lied.
I have been dishonest.
And gave back five Olympic medals.
Here goes Michael Vick.
The Falcons quarterback said he was not involved in dog fighting, but dogs were found on his property, hanged, drowned, and electrocuted.
Dog killer!
Vick now behind bars after pleading guilty to conspiracy.
I'm totally responsible. Those things just didn't have to happen.
NBA commissioner called ref Tim Donaghy
a rogue, isolated criminal.
Donaghy passed along inside info on games and pleaded guilty to conspiracy. Dave Barrett, CBS News.
Some of the top stories of 2007 from the correspondents of CBS News. I'm Howard Arenstein.
This is the CBS News Year-End Roundup, a wrap-up of the year with the correspondents who cover the news on the CBS Radio Network. This is the CBS News Year-End Roundup.
The Census Bureau tells us sales of TVs and video monitors that are digital this year totaled $26 billion in the U.S., triple what the sales were 4 years ago. And sales of MP3 players, including iPods, increased by well over 1,000% this year, $6 billion. More from CBS's Jim Taylor.
Give Me Another Year of Downloading.
It seems so easy that it's almost not like stealing.
The world now gets its music for free, gets its music online, and gets its music without permission.
And another year of online fear.
I am that 13-year-old girl who was lured by an internet predator.
Another cool product from Apple.
The shinier and the more blinky buttons it has, I'm like a moth to a flame when it comes to electronics.
Yeah, the iPhone. Calling you. Sending email, voicemail, and texting on our thumb-worn Blackberries.
Don't constantly do this for 30 minutes straight without taking a break.
1 in 5, do it while we drive.
And not only do people jeopardize their own lives, but they're jeopardizing the lives of everybody else on the road.
It's enough to make you want to lose yourself in the latest high-tech video game.
How about biotechnology? Just last month, a new way to make human stem cells that could help the search for treatments and cures without using embryos. CBS News medical correspondent Dr. John LaPook, you call this the breakthrough of the year by researchers.
Two different groups who were able to take plain old skin cells and a little hocus pocus throwing in some four genes into them out of the 20,000 that we have in our body. Four little genes were able to morph these skin cells back into stem cells. And then once they were stem cells, you were able to then tease them back up to become other types of cells in the body. And dramatically, for example, they took skin cells from a woman's face. They made them into stem cells, and then they teased them back up into becoming a beating heart cell.
That's quite a feat of bioengineering, but even on that first day, you reported that there seems to be a cancer risk around those newly created stem cells.
Yeah, that is a problem. Of course, nothing's ever perfect, and right now there is a technical problem that the very process by which you mess around with the DNA, with the chromosomes of these cells in order to turn them from skin cells back into stem cells, increases the chance that those stem cells will eventually turn into cancer. So right away, initially, we cannot use them to say we can't give them to anybody because they might turn into cancer. But that's not the most exciting thing right now. The most exciting thing is that right now, and I mean tomorrow, people all around the world, laboratories all around the world, are going to be able to start making these stem cells and studying what goes wrong in disease.
Dr. John LaPook, our medical correspondent. Just before a Christmas recess, Congress passed and President Bush signed a long-awaited energy bill. It requires better gasoline mileage for cars and trucks, and the incandescent light bulb will be phased out in favor of energy-efficient fluorescent and halogen bulbs. A CBS News correspondent, Bob Fuss, what else did Congress accomplish?
Well, you know, the Democrats came in pledging to do a lot of things, changing a lot of things. They managed to get some things done, but they ran into a brick wall at the White House for most of the others, including a measure with broad bipartisan support to expand the children's health insurance program. You know, President Bush had 6 years with a Congress that basically did whatever he wanted and left his administration alone, and that changed dramatically this year. The House passed lots of bills that were killed by Republican filibusters in the Senate or stopped by vetoes, and the Congress started a dozen investigations into administration actions, one of which led to the ouster of Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, all of which caused a lot of heartaches at the White House. The president was forced to back down this year on several controversial policies by Congress, including doing those warrantless wiretaps without congressional authority, and the Democrats did manage to get some measures into law. The first raise in the minimum wage in 10 years, a very big increase in college aid, including cutting interest rates on college loans in half, a big ethics reform measure for Congress itself, and adopting many of the remaining recommendations of the 9/11 Commission, including stricter security inspection at ports. The president opposed most of those at the beginning, but later backed down. He did also have his first veto overturned on a bill funding water projects around the country. All year, the president and Congress fought over money, the president always wanting more for Iraq, the Democrats wanting more for everything else.
And Bob, on the subject of the war in Iraq, it wasn't only about money. A lot of Democrats in Congress tried to get involved also in the strategy and especially troop pullout questions.
They tried, and they failed. Iraq was the elephant under the dome here all year long. This was what Congress kept coming back to over and over and over again. There were endless debates. And Democrats came into power on the promise to try to end the war. And the polls show it was the key issue on voters' minds when they chose the Democrats instead of the Republicans in the 2006 elections. They kept trying, but they got nowhere. You know, they passed bills to require changes in strategy, to set a goal for withdrawing troops. They tried to cut the funds reduce the funds. President Bush refused to compromise on any of it. He vetoed some bills, held firm on all the decisions on the war that he would make them and Congress would not. And the Democrats were never able to muster the votes they'd need from the Republicans to force troops out of Iraq. If, though, Iraq is as big an issue in the 2008 elections as they were in, as it was in 2006, then what they did accomplish is that they put a number of Republicans in swing districts in a vulnerable position, since they're now on record voting again and again to support the president and an unpopular war.
Now, I would have expected that Democrats could get a lot passed in the House, but in the Senate, where the process really requires you to have 60 votes, the Democrats did not get that agenda through.
Well, that's right. I mean, other than the things I mentioned earlier that did get accomplished, all of the things that didn't get accomplished, all the things that got stopped in the Senate. The House was able to pass everything the Democrats wanted. It's the way it works, the structure. In the Senate, as you mentioned, it takes 60 votes to do anything. The Democrats don't have 60 votes, and they were not able to really get that on a lot of issues. The president had two ways to stop the Democratic Congress. One was Republican filibusters in the Senate, which was very effective on those few issues that he couldn't use that and lost enough Republicans that the Democrats could get something through the Senate. He then had his veto.
CBS's Bob Fuss covering Congress. Hearings are now being planned over the CIA's confirmation that it had videotapes of Al-Qaeda men being interrogated, but destroyed the tapes. Flight delays were worse than ever this year. The aviation system overcrowded, unable to cope with bad weather. Federal experts trace most of the problems to the air lanes around New York, where CBS's Steve Kathan reports a new action plan.
First and foremost, fewer flights during peak periods.
Sounds great, but how could you? It's impossible.
That man catching a flight here in New York has doubts these flight restrictions hoped for by next summer would affect the three major airports in New York City in an effort to ease delays around the country. But fewer flights will likely mean higher prices.
Well, I would not be a happy camper. I like my cheap flights.
How much more will we pay? Passenger advocate David Stempler.
If you cut flights by 20%, it wouldn't be unreasonable to have an increase in at least 20% in fares.
Steve Kathan, CBS News, New York.
And I'm Dan Revive in Washington. Hope you're having a great holiday time. Coming up, Howard Arenstein brings us Candidates for President, questioned by Katie Couric.
Stay with us. The CBS News Year-End Roundup will be right back. This is the CBS News Year-End Roundup.
I'm Howard Arenstein. This year-end is unique because the 2008 political schedule starts so early. So this year we decided to give you a chance to hear 10 of the candidates all answer the same questions from CBS Evening News anchor Katie Couric. Here are their answers to this question.
Do you think in any way the risks of climate change are being overhyped?
Democrat John Edwards.
I don't think it's being overhyped. I think it's being underhyped. I'd make polluters pay, people who below the cap are still putting out carbon dioxide. And that money from making the polluters pay for a permit to do that should be invested in clean, renewable sources of energy, wind, solar, cellulose-based biofuels. We have to clean up our act. As we start cleaning up our act, I think we're in a place to be able to go to China, to India, to the other countries that need to be part of the solution and say, we're developing the technology. We're willing to make this technology available to you, but we're going to have to solve this problem together.
Republican Fred Thompson.
There are a lot of unanswered questions. We don't know to what extent this is a cyclical thing that we may or may not be able to affect very much. The extremists, I think, are the ones who want us to do drastic things to our economy before we have more answers as to how much good we can do and whether or not people in the other parts of the world are going to contribute. But it needs to be a massive federal research and development effort in order to get those answers.
Democrat Hillary Clinton.
I don't think that it's overhyped. I think that we have time, but we have to start acting now. I would put a heavy emphasis on energy efficiency. We can drastically lower our use of electricity, thereby drastically lowering our use of coal-powered electricity. We need to have higher gas mileage, and I have advocated 40 miles per gallon by 2020, and I believe that's achievable, but we're going to have to help Detroit do it. I don't want to sacrifice jobs. I don't want the American auto industry to go out of business, so I'm willing to give significant help as they make this transition. I want to lead the world in a post-Kyoto agreement that I hope we can get resolved and signed by 2010 that will include China and India.
Republican Mike Huckabee.
I don't know. I mean, the honest answer for me scientifically is I don't know. I think that Republicans have made a big mistake by not being more on the forefront of conservation. I consider myself a conservationist. I think we ought to have some cap and trade. It worked with acid rain. I think it could work with CO2 emissions. I think we ought to be out there talking about ways to reduce energy consumption and waste. And we ought to declare that we will be oil-free of energy consumption in this country within a decade. Bold as that is, frankly, it's a matter of national security to get to the point where we're not dependent upon oil coming from countries who, frankly, aren't very friendly to us.
Do you think the risks of climate change are overblown?
Democrat Barack Obama.
No. I think they're serious. We have to take significant steps now to deal with it. So I've put forward a very substantial proposal to get 80% reductions in greenhouse gases by 2050. That is going to require that we change how power plants operate. That's going to require that we increase fuel efficiency standards, that we develop clean and renewable sources like solar and wind and biodiesel. You know, we're going to have to charge for pollution and create a market for pollution abatement and create green technologies.
Republican Mitt Romney.
I think the risks of climate change are real, and that you're seeing climate change. I think human activity is contributing to it. I would develop in this country sources of energy which will allow us to be free of foreign oil, but sources also that don't emit CO2, and that's nuclear power, clean burning coal, all of our renewable resources, and so forth. I also want to see much greater efficiency in our autos, in our homes, in our businesses. That'll get us energy independent. I don't want to have America unilaterally think it's going to somehow stop global warming. They don't call it America warming. They call it global warming. And that means China, which is the biggest CO2 emitter in the world, as well as other nations like Indonesia and Brazil, are going to have to be part of a global effort.
Democrat Bill Richardson.
No. I think, if anything, they're underblown. Three things I would do is I would have fuel efficiency in all vehicles 50 miles per gallon. The second, I would say all electricity in this country, 30% by the year 2020, has to come from renewable energy, solar, wind, biomass. And the third would be, I would put a mandate that says that we are going to have a reduction of greenhouse gas emissions by 80% by the year 2040.
Republican Rudy Giuliani.
There is global warming. Human beings are contributing to it. And I think the best answer to it is energy independence. We've got more coal reserves in the United States than they have oil reserves in Saudi Arabia. If we find a way to deal with it and use it so it doesn't hurt the environment, we're going to find ourselves not contributing to global warming and also being more energy independent. I think we have to take another look at nuclear power. It has to be done very carefully, but we haven't lost a life to nuclear power yet. We have wind, solar, hydroelectric, hybrid vehicles, and an appropriate emphasis on conservation.
Democrat Joe Biden.
I think Al Gore has done something really quite phenomenal. He has brought into the consciousness the reality of what is going to happen unless we change behavior. I literally would make an executive order saying the United States government would not purchase one single vehicle that didn't get 45 miles of the gallon, and would not, it is a fleet, all the vehicles we buy, and would not build one single building that did not, that was not green, use green technology. Out in Iowa, everybody's talking about ethanol, and they're producing all kinds of ethanol. I say, by the way, ethanol, great. And they go, yeah, great for my state. I say, how many ethanol gas stations you got out here? And they go, no, they're not. So the second thing is you got to build an infrastructure that the federal government has to be the catalyst for.
Republican John McCain.
I've been to Greenland. I've been to the South Pole. I've been to the Arctic. I know it's real. And I believe that we've got to go back to nuclear power. We've got to do alternate energy. We need to do green technologies. Let me just put it this way to you. Suppose that I'm wrong and there's no such thing as climate change and we adopt green technologies, then we've just left our kids a better world. Suppose I am right and we do nothing. Then what kind of a planet have we handed to our children? I've been involved in this effort for many years, and we've got to act, and unfortunately, we have not acted either as the federal government or the Congress.
Why has it taken so long, Senator?
Special interests. It's a special interest. It's the utility companies and the petroleum companies and the other special interests. They're the ones that have blocked progress in the Congress of the United States and in the administration. That's a little straight talk.
10 candidates all answering Katie Couric's question about whether the dangers of global warming are being overhyped.
Suffering and pain in Rawalpindi, where Pakistan's first female prime minister, Benazir Bhutto, was killed. At one of her political rallies, shots were fired and an attacker blew himself up. After serving as prime minister twice, she was in exile, seen as a pro-Western moderate. She returned to her country in October. Immediately, a suicide bomber tried to kill her and did murder more than 100 Pakistanis. Now she is dead. At his ranch in Texas on Thursday morning, President Bush declared,
"The United States strongly condemns this cowardly act by murderous extremists who are trying to undermine Pakistan's democracy. We stand with the people of Pakistan in their struggle against the forces of terror and extremism. We urge them to honor Benazir Bhutto's memory by continuing with the democratic process for which she so bravely gave her life."
And we asked commentator Marvin Kalb with Harvard's Shorenstein Center, why should Americans care?
Pakistan has nuclear weapons. Pakistan is now clearly entering a new phase of wild kind of political instability. So the question comes up, who is going to exercise firm control over those weapons, over the use of those weapons?
Plus the fact that the head of al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden, is believed to be hiding in Pakistan near the border with Afghanistan. We turn to Neil Livingston, head of a security consulting company, Executive Action. Neil, Benazir Bhutto had suggested she would truly crack down on al-Qaeda.
She said, look, if I get back in power, and she may not have been able to deliver, but at least she was saying the right thing. She said, I'll give you Osama bin Laden's head within 90 days.
So from a U.S. point of view, she wanted to do something dramatic, like capture Osama bin Laden. But on a wider scale, did she claim that President Musharraf is not a genuine friend of the U.S.?
She never said he's not a genuine friend of the United States, but she did say that he's not the best friend that you could have in Pakistan. Her view was always that a democratically elected government was the best friend the United States could have in Pakistan, and she pointed out that in the long run, the best thing for the United States and the best thing for, quite frankly, the progressive elements within the Muslim world was for restoration of democracy in Pakistan, and she felt she could win any election there.
Now, you knew her personally. You'd consider yourself a friend of Benazir's?
Oh, absolutely.
Did you counsel her at all about security arrangements? That, after all, is your specialty, Neil. What did you tell her when she said that she planned to go back to Pakistan?
Well, I had many conversations with her about her security and conversations with those around her, including her husband. I think she always believed that it was going to take a silver bullet to kill her. She believed that she had a destiny and she was very fatalistic.
She must have felt that politics in Pakistan is retail. You have to be out there. The people have to actually feel you and touch you. And she was going to do that, whatever the risk.
Yeah, she wanted to be part of the Pakistani political process. You know, there were always criticisms of her that she had been educated at Harvard and Oxford, that she spoke English better than any of the languages that are spoken in Pakistan. And as a consequence, I think she felt the need to press the flesh, as we say in the United States. Now, that said, I counseled her on a number of occasions that that could still be done, and without compromising her ability to get out with the crowds, but that she needed American-style security, a security not unlike the Secret Service renders for the President of the United States. Her death could plunge the entire region into chaos, and then certainly Pakistan, and undermine Musharraf. Who knows whether Benazir would have won the upcoming election, that she was going to be a very formidable candidate, and in many respects, probably would have been Musharraf's greatest ally if they had been able to broker a deal where he stayed as president and she returned as prime minister.
That's Neil Livingston with the company Executive Action. More from CBS News correspondent Sam Litzinger.
Politics was part of Benazir Bhutto's being. Her father had been the country's president and then prime minister. He was hanged by Pakistan's military leaders not far from where she was killed. They imprisoned her, but she defeated them by twice becoming prime minister. Her government was accused of nepotism, and she fled after corruption charges were brought against her. But this year, she returned.
I feel very, very emotional.
coming back to my country. I dreamt of this day for so many months and years. I counted the hours, I counted the minutes and the seconds.
I interviewed Bhutto several years ago in London. She struck me as a woman who lives sometimes uneasily in two worlds, one in which Muslim tradition was central and one in which political, social, and technological changes came quickly. She said she was guided by her love of Pakistan, something she also told the Christian Science Monitor.
It is this love that actually motivates me to continue. I really wish that I can see democracy dawn. And democracy for me is not just elections. It's about building institutions. It's about a pluralistic, tolerant society.
Bhutto spoke with Afghanistan's President Hamid Karzai not long before she was killed.
She sacrificed her life for the sake of Pakistan and for the sake of this region.
She leaves behind a husband from an arranged marriage. She once said she wasn't free to marry for love. They had three children. Benazir Bhutto was 54 years old, and to many, she has now become a martyr.
That's CBS's Sam Litzinger. Much to worry about, and suddenly an extra topic for America's presidential campaign. We're very close now to real votes being counted. Iowa's caucuses this coming Thursday evening, January 3rd. Then the New Hampshire primary, January 8th. As CBS News chief Washington correspondent Bob Schieffer, this campaign started early in 07, but now Americans are paying attention.
Oh, there's no question they're paying attention. And the other part is it's really getting good. There are great races on both sides. I don't think anybody at this point could predict who's going to be the nominee of either party. And it's just going to kind of be fun from here on in.
What happened that early 2008 we're going to have such a different primary schedule? By February 5th, it could all be decided, maybe on both sides.
Well, that's exactly right. And it favors, when you push all the primaries to the front like this and bunch them up like this, it does favor the person who has the most money in the bank.
Coming up, the Tiger attack in San Francisco, then more of our review of 2007.
Stay with us. The CBS News Year-End Roundup will be right back. This is the CBS News Year-End Roundup. Once again, here's Dan Revie.
Back to our review of 2007 in a moment. First, CBS News correspondent John Blackstone at the zoo in San Francisco, where a tiger somehow escaped, killed one visitor, severely injured two others. Then that tiger was shot dead by police officers.
The tiger that attacked in San Francisco mauled one of its keepers just 1 year ago, ripping flesh from her arm during a public feeding session. The zoo stopped the public feedings for a few months and made changes to the enclosure. It didn't blame the tiger.
The tiger was acting like a normal tiger does.
The public feeding has since resumed. It's a crowd pleaser, but it amounts to inciting the animal, says one zoo critic.
This public feeding spectacle exacerbates the problem and creates an animal that really is hostile to the keeper and to the public.
Elliot Katz is with PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. On Thursday, the director of the San Francisco Zoo said the wall around the tiger enclosure was not built as high as it should have been. Let's go back to politics. CBS News chief White House correspondent Jim Axelrod. You've been out with the candidates in Iowa especially. Jim, this is the first time since 1952 that there's no incumbent president or vice president running for the White House. So it's wide open, kind of strange.
It is. I think the Democrats are beginning to realize that it is not a done deal. It's going to be a little bit more of a neck-and-neck race, certainly, than Hillary Clinton anticipated, and Barack Obama most recently has found his voice. The Republicans, to me, it's almost a more interesting story because it's still not just two people at it. It's two, three, four, and you really have to wait to see how things unfold in Iowa, New Hampshire, then South Carolina, and then on to the big February 5th super primary day to really get a sense of even an emerging Republican. So it's going to be a fascinating next couple of weeks and months.
I predict an interesting 08. CBS News chief White House correspondent Jim Axelrod. Thanks and Happy New Year, Jim.
Thank you, Dan.
Aside from the assassination of Pakistan's opposition leader Benazir Bhutto, other big foreign headlines in 2007? Let's hear from CBS News reporter Vicky Barker in London.
100,000 dancers in a North Korean stadium. 2007 saw North Korea agree to dismantle its nuclear facilities and allow inspectors in. But Iran still refusing to dance to the UN's tune, despite new sanctions over its nuclear program. In Afghanistan, renewed Taliban attacks. In Burma, thousands of Buddhist monks marched for democracy until the generals struck back.
We and the Palestinians will sit together in Jerusalem and work out something that will be very good.
2007 closing with one more U.S. attempt to forge a Middle East peace deal, and that should run well into 2008 and beyond.
So from a U.S. point of view, our standing in the world, let's turn again to commentator Marvin Kalb. You saw some change this year.
The Bush administration has turned its policy around. Whereas in the past it was almost exclusively unilateralism, moving into Iraq, it is now beginning to move toward a kind of multilateralism, which might suggest that Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is getting her way within the administration over the Vice President, Mr. Cheney. There is also a sense that a number of large powers in the world are beginning to do their thing without any recognition of the power and influence of the United States. In other words, in their minds, we might be becoming a nation of the past.
Does that reflect, at least as seen at the beginning of the year, a sense that the Iraq War was a failure for the U.S.?
Well, the Iraq War certainly made us think that Iraq was the center of the universe. It wasn't, and it isn't. But we acted as though it were. And that meant that the rest of the world, which has so many problems bursting forth, the rest of the world said, my God, the United States can no longer really get its priorities in order. Iraq is important. It became even more important after the American invasion of Iraq. But at this particular time, think about Iran. Think about the Palestinian-Israeli problem. Think about the rise of China. Think about the chaos in Russia, and yet managed so effectively by an increasingly authoritarian Vladimir Putin. So the rest of the world is moving, and we seem to be trying to catch up. Everyone has always been afraid, no, no, we should not do another Vietnam. We should not get into a quagmire. But in fact, the United States is now in Iraq, and people on both sides of the argument are beginning to accept the idea that we're going to be there for a very long time indeed. As a matter of fact, a number of the State Department people are trying to find a parallel with Korea, where the U.S. went in 1950-51, and we've been there ever since.
Now, there might be something to that. The U.S. has been in Korea as part of a plan to bring some stability to Asia. The Middle East really needs stability. It's not a foolish idea.
If you are prepared to acknowledge that the United States knows what it's doing, and by committing large-scale forces to different parts of the world, it is with a specific global strategy in mind. To pick up one of the president's favorite and persistent slogans about bringing democracy and freedom to the world. Absolutely, it's a wonderful idea. But it could be that the world, or many parts of it, is not yet ready for democracy and freedom.
Marvin, we haven't yet mentioned the word terrorism, and so what's behind the Bush doctrine is to bring democracy and freedom to that part of the world, hopefully prosperity. People won't be so angry at us, and eventually there'd be fewer terrorists.
On this issue, I think everyone is in agreement, regardless of which side of the Iraq problem you're on. Everyone is in agreement that in order to somehow move against terrorism, you've got to move in the direction of building more schools, more housing, increased job opportunities. In other words, you've got to deal with the soft power of America and America's promise rather than the hard power. And I think that that is where we may also be changing in the last year and perhaps as we go into a new one. Think about the glorious things that the U.S. did after World War II. Raising the standard of living in Western Europe, trying to help all other parts of the world get back a little bit to those traditional, solid American values. That, I think, is something that we could see as we go into the new year.
As we do look ahead to 2008, the biggest question mark for Americans is, who's going to be the next president? And so on the foreign affairs front, I think the voters usually want more of a feeling, oh, he or she knows what they're talking about.
There is a feeling that you get of comfort with a candidate, but I'm not really sure that the American people are yet listening. There are so many studies that indicate that Americans get really serious about a presidential campaign somewhere around September or October. In other words, only a month or two before they actually vote.
at the Shorenstein Center, part of Harvard University. That's foreign affairs analyst and commentator Marvin Kalb. Marvin, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Up next, the Supreme Court, then high-tech gadgets such as the iPhone.
Stay with us. The CBS News Year-End Roundup will be right back. This is the CBS News Year-End Roundup. Once again, here's correspondent Dan Ravine.
The Supreme Court is considered a prize, perhaps, for the winner of next year's presidential election if more vacancies occur on the court, which for years now has been finely balanced, a lot of 5-4 decisions, though on many issues it's been moving toward what's usually called conservative. Correspondent Barry Bagnato covers our highest court.
The High Court solidified its conservative credentials, dealing abortion rights supporters a blow by upholding a ban on so-called partial birth abortions.
States have a legitimate interest in protecting the unborn child's life.
Voluntary school integration plans were scuttled in metropolitan Louisville and Seattle, where Kathleen Brose's white daughter was kept out of the school she wanted.
This is the United States of America. It shouldn't matter what your skin color is.
Cars spewing greenhouse gases. In its first climate change ruling, the court tells the EPA you can't avoid regulating them. Now before the justices, is it right that crack cocaine punishments are 100 times greater than for powder? Are lethal injection executions cruel and unusual punishment? Florida reporter Nathan Crabb witnessed one.
He was wincing. He was shuddering.
Also in the court's crosshairs, can D.C. ban handguns? Or do Americans as individuals have a right to possess guns to fight criminals, as the NRA contends?
The only thing that works is confront them directly and take them off the street.
Barry Bagnato, CBS News.
Now let's turn to gadgets and gizmos and business. All right, all of that is old-fashioned, of course. The new thing is anything that's connected, that's networked, that's broadband. You probably have a lot of it in your home. If you're not that familiar with it, you hear about it, and often from CBS News technology correspondent Daniel Seberg, who joins us. I want to start with a hot product this year, Daniel, the iPhone from Apple. So Apple, not just a software company, not just a laptop and home computer company, they decided to get into making cell phones, and it was an immediate success. Millions sold. Why?
Even before they even hit the market, they were a big success. When Steve Jobs made this announcement about a year ago, people were clamoring for this. The hype was unbelievable for the iPhone. There were the doubters out there, the ones who wondered whether they should partner with AT&T as a provider.
You have to use that cell phone provider as of now.
Exactly, and for probably quite a while. So there were those who wondered if Apple could do it right, but the iPod was done so well that people really thought that they could trust Apple to make this work.
We're talking about ease of use. We're talking about beauty of the design. What do you think it is?
A little bit of everything, because that's what Apple is known for, that sort of sleek design. It's got a cool factor that comes packaged with it now. Of course, it's easy to forget that even, say, 10 or 15 years ago, Apple was thought of as an extremely niche company, and they still are in many ways with their personal computers. But people had forgotten about Steve Jobs. They had forgotten that Apple could innovate. And once the iPod started to gather steam starting in, say, 2001, it didn't stop. And the iPhone is just the next generation of what they've been doing.
What's with YouTube? We notice, for instance, the iPhone has easy access to YouTube to watch these videos, which are often amateur clips. So everybody on Earth is now doing television. Where's that going?
Yeah, YouTube is still maintaining its popularity, which I think surprises a lot of people. I kind of expected YouTube to peter out and drop off a little bit. But because there have been shows or programs targeted just for a YouTube audience, or crazy, wacky videos that get forwarded around. And there are YouTube competitors out there, so like Break or Brightcove or others, that are really giving YouTube a little bit of competition. And with websites like Digg.com, so Digg.com, that's basically where you can feel the undercurrent of the internet. So whatever is really popular at a time gets posted there. And a lot of those are YouTube videos, so that maintains its popularity.
What about social networking? Facebook and other sites where you can easily become a member. You can get in touch with people you know or people you don't know who start labeling themselves as your friends. Wow, I mean, that's exploded.
It really has. The idea of social networking, I guess it kind of started in the mainstream with something like MySpace. But the thing about MySpace is that it tends to be a little bit more about me. Here's me. Here's what I'm about. Here's some photos of me. And oh, by the way, in the corner here are some of my friends. But Facebook really focuses on the community aspect of people. So you get to see what all of your friends are doing at any one time of the day. You get to see their photos. You get to hear who they're hanging out with or where they've traveled to. And you feel like you have this connection to them. You may not not really, and you're not necessarily developing or growing these relationships. But you can go back and find people from 10 or 15 years ago. And see
Facebook was just for college students at the start, but not now.
It absolutely just started for college. In fact, it started for Ivy League schools in the beginning, then eventually expanded out to colleges. And now you see a lot of people who are over 40, over 50, over 60, who find a reason to use it. Maybe their kids started, and now they've met their own friends.
Let's not be naive. These things exist and thrive and are very visible on the web because they make money for media corporations.
Facebook, though, is one of those somewhat rare websites that has not been completely bought out by a larger company yet.
MySpace is owned by News Corporation, which owns Fox.
Absolutely. So they have got their own money. In a sense, you could say they sort of sold out. But Mark Zuckerberg, who's in his early 20s, who founded Facebook, has really been resistant to a larger company like Google or Yahoo or Microsoft coming in and sort of taking it over. He has certainly accepted advertising dollars, and he has to keep it running, and he's doing very, very well for himself. He's had huge offers in the hundreds of millions, if not billions. But for one reason or another, he's still not totally giving into all of that, as tempting as that is for a guy his age.
Say, when it comes to technology, including home entertainment, look ahead to 2008, just more of the same, or you never know?
I think that what we're definitely going to be seeing is a lot more high-definition acceptance. So as the prices for plasma and LCD TVs start to come down, they're at a very Goldilocks level for people right now. So they're not – prices aren't too big. TVs aren't too big. You know, they sort of realize that this is the way to go. More programming is available in high definition as networks realize this is what people want. And so that, I think, is going to be a continued trend. Also, you're going to see a lot of people buying iPhone competitors. If they haven't already bought an iPhone, they might look at something from Verizon like the Voyager, which also has that touchscreen. You know, you're going to see lots of copycats out there that are trying to copy the latest and greatest thing. GPS in cell phones is certainly becoming a bigger thing. And another device which is getting a little bit of notice lately is Amazon's Kindle. So it's the e-book reader, basically. So you can load in dozens or hundreds of books into this fairly small device and carry it around with you. It's gotten some bad reviews in terms of its aesthetic design.
It's kind of a plasticky, well, it's meant to be like a piece of paper, but it's, well, it's this plasticky thing. Not very attractive, but it is incredible. Dozens of books just with you. It's light.
Right, and free wireless access with it. So if you're anywhere in the Sprint network, you can go and download a book at any time you feel like it. And the type, the font, when you look at the screen, there's no backlight. But the way that they've done this e-ink is quite amazing to the eye. It's very pleasing. It's not, there's no eye strain. And Sony has its own version of this out there, the Sony Reader. So there's a little bit of competition in terms of the electronic book market. But I wish I could predict exactly what's going to happen in the year ahead. It's just as much fun to wait and see what happens sometimes.
That's CBS News technology correspondent Daniel Seberg in New York. And reviewing 2007, I'm Dan Revive in Washington.
This is the CBS News Year-End Roundup, a wrap-up of the year with the correspondents who cover the news on the CBS Radio Network. This is the CBS News Year-End Roundup. Once again, here's Dan Revive.
We continue to see people famous in the world of entertainment getting in legal trouble. Some examples from CBS News correspondent Harley Carnes.
Record producer Phil Spector faced the music at his murder trial this year, where one witness testified.
He said, "I think I killed somebody."
But the jury deadlocked on whether Spector killed actress Lana Clarkson, so the judge declared a mistrial. Prosecutors say they will retry the case. Then there was Paris Hilton, who was sentenced to jail time for driving with a suspended license while on probation.
I feel that I was treated unfairly and that the sentence is both cruel and unwarranted, and I don't deserve it.
She served 23 days. Lindsay Lohan later did some time, an entire 84 minutes for drunk driving in the same lockup.
The state of Nevada versus Orenthal James Simpson.
O.J. charged with armed robbery and kidnapping in a case involving sports memorabilia. An explosive audio tape of the alleged event even posted on TMZ.com. The trial begins next April. But for Fred Goldman, whose son Ron was stabbed to death along with Simpson's ex-wife Nicole in 1994.
It's never going to go away.
Harley Carnes, CBS News.
Now to Florida. Correspondent Peter King covers the space program, which was busy up in orbit, and there was a strange criminal case.
Houston now controlling.
Shuttle astronauts flew millions of miles in space, but it was one astronaut's 1,000-mile drive that made the biggest news.
Ms. Nowak, did you intend to murder Mason?
Navy Captain Lisa Nowak was charged with attacking a romantic rival for the affections of another astronaut. Police found weapons and used diapers in her car.
She said that she used the diapers in order to pee so that she didn't have to make as many stops.
But a judge tossed much of the evidence and a police interview. Nowak apologized to the woman she says she just wanted to talk to.
I would like her to know how very sorry I am about having frightened her in any way.
Nowak's trial is slated for April. An independent review of the astronaut screening process later turned up reports of astronauts drunk before flying. NASA says its own probe turned up nothing. The public airing of all this dirty laundry overshadowed an otherwise big year in space.
Here it comes.
Four shuttle flights and more than 20 spacewalks to expand the International Space Station.
Nice handiwork.
Peter King, CBS News.
600 miles per hour.
Now CBS News medical correspondent Dr. Jonathan LaPook. John, there was a lot of progress this year in fighting cancer. Treatment is getting a lot more specific, tailored to each cancer patient.
Tailored, personalized treatment. I mean, it really absolutely is amazing what's happened in cancer. People who are of a certain age, let us say that age is over 60, they hear the words cancer and they just think, you're going to die, you know, because years ago, if you had cancer, there weren't a lot of things that you could do. Now, there's tremendous hope, and we're actually seeing a drop in the death rate from cancer overall at about 2% per year. It's actually the death rates are dropping at about 2% per year from 2002 to 2004, and almost 5% in colon cancer. And one of the reasons, you know, you get earlier detection, that's great, but also the treatments are now targeted, as you say. For example, we used to take basically the equivalent of a 2x4 and smack somebody over the head with it if they had cancer and hope that we killed the cancer cells, you know, before we damaged you too badly. Now we think, you know what, let's be a little bit more elegant with our treatment. Let's learn something about the biology, about what makes the cancer cell different from a normal cell. And then let's exploit that difference and try to hit, you know, figure out what the Achilles heel is of the cancer. Take breast cancer. Breast cancers have receptors on their surfaces, things that help fuel them, that help make them grow. Then there are ways of working on the inside of the cell. There's an amazing drug called Gleevec, which helps decrease the growth of a cancer cell by attacking it on the inside of its cell. And in patients who have leukemia, this has been almost a miracle drug. And then you have a drug like Avastin, which is a part of a type of drug that block the blood vessel supply to a tumor. So you help starve it from nutrition, and that's been used to treat lung cancer and colon cancer. The other thing about personalized medicine, which has been amazing, is people like Bert Vogelstein down at Hopkins have found that there's tremendous different variation in the gene mutations in colon and breast cancer and probably other cancers from person to person. So it's not like one size fits all. So the next frontier you're going to see is somebody has a cancer, you analyze that specific cancer for its genetic makeup and other factors, things that make it unique from, say, the person down the block who has a cancer, and then you tailor the cancer therapy depending upon what specific qualities that person's own cancer has. And that is a very, very exciting frontier for the future.
Would I be right to be concerned it's also expensive, the research and the treatment? So do all Americans share the benefits?
No, all Americans do not share the benefits. And this is something that a lot of us are concerned of and is really unacceptable. Let's just look at colon cancer, okay? African Americans have a 40% higher mortality rate from colon cancer than other groups. Now, why is that? There may be some biological differences in that. For example, colon cancer has more of a tendency to be in the right side of the colon in African Americans than other groups. But really, most of us believe that the vast majority of this difference is from difference in access to care. So this is a group that we really are not doing well enough by.
And some of that does figure into the political campaign in 2008. Dr. LaPook, you are a working physician. Do you and your colleagues think there will be a major change in how health care is financed, how it's paid for in the U.S.?
I think there has to be. We all know that the costs are just out of control, that there's a huge number of people, 47 million Americans, who are uninsured. This is unacceptable. We're talking about life and death here, And it's got, we have to have an answer. I mean, previous attempts to figure out a way to get everybody covered have been unsuccessful. And I think you're now seeing a groundswell where people are just not going to stand for it to not have adequate health care coverage for the majority of Americans.
Part of our year-end roundup, CBS News medical correspondent Dr. John LaPook. Happy holidays and Happy New Year, John.
Happy holidays, Happy New Year to you.
Back now to entertainment, a review of the year by CBS's Bill Bregoli.
The movies in 2007 brought us sequels, threequels.
You're mad.
And The Simpsons.
Spider Pig, Spider Pig.
First, 300 surprised us.
This is where we hold them.
Then things looked familiar.
Weapon!
The third, Pirates of the Caribbean. Shrek the Third, Spider-Man 3, and The Bourne Ultimatum.
They can't stop me.
Also the fourth, Die Hard.
I'm going to kill this guy.
And the fifth, Harry Potter.
If Voldemort's raising an army, then I want to fight.
There was some originality in Ratatouille.
He's ruining the soup.
Transformers. Giant robots.
I want to introduce you to my friend, Optimus Prime.
And R-rated fun in Knocked Up.
I'm pregnant.
With a baby?
A record $4 billion summer. In the fall...
You have my husband!
Rendition bombed, but the game plan scored.
I am not qualified for this.
The holidays brought us Charlie Wilson's War.
I want the CIA in my office at 10.
And a dark musical.
Sweeney Todd.
Darker still...
Strike! Shut him down!
A writer's strike cast a shadow on 2008.
A lot of TV production halted by that strike, mainly over how much writers should be paid when programs are on DVDs or the Internet. Up next, CBS's Howard Arenstein on what candidates for president told Katie Couric.
Stay with us. The CBS News Year-End Roundup will be right back. This is the CBS News Year-End Roundup.
I'm Howard Arenstein. This year-end is unique because the 2008 political schedule starts so early. So this year we decided to give you a chance to hear 10 of the candidates all answer the same questions from CBS Evening News anchor Katie Couric. Here are their answers to this question.
What country frightens you the most and what would you do about it as president?
Democrat Barack Obama.
I think Iran poses a significant threat to stability in the Middle East. So I think we have to talk to Iran directly. And when we talk to Iran directly, even if there are profound disagreements there, that will send a signal to the world that we are not simply seeking to impose our will without paying attention to what other countries think. And that kind of dialogue has not taken place. This president has refused to do it. And I think it's a profound mistake. JFK once said we should never negotiate out of fear, but we should never fear to negotiate.
Republican Fred Thompson.
Iran, I think that they have a zealotry among the mullahs there, and they have been killing our people for a long time through Hezbollah and other terrorist organizations. And we, of course, cannot take military action off the table, but if we have to go in that direction, it'll probably be looked upon as, or should be looked upon as a failure of ours if we have to get down to the point of doing that. We have a lot of levers there in terms of sanctions, in terms of supporting people inside the country of Iran. Their economy is in shambles. Their demonstration is going on all the time. They're suppressing their people. They're killing dissidents and students and things of that nature. Some of that issue might be resolved for us. You never know what the end result of that scenario would be either. But it would be better than the track we're on now.
Democrat Hillary Clinton.
Well, right now I am most worried about Pakistan. I think Pakistan is very unstable. I believe President Musharraf has failed to deliver on either democracy or a rising standard of living for his people. You know, democracy has to be carefully nurtured. I would put the United States firmly on the side of the Pakistani people and on behalf of those who are agitating for democracy and for rights. I mean, it's almost touching to see lawyers, well-dressed lawyers in the streets. I think the United States should be supporting those kinds of voices inside Pakistan.
Republican John McCain.
Probably now Iran is the greatest threat, but the greatest threat is radical Islamic extremism. And one of the reasons why it's such a great threat, it spills over any international boundaries. It's in Denmark, it's in Germany, it's in Glasgow, Scotland, and it's trying to establish itself here in the United States of America, according to the director of the CIA. That's the great threat.
What do you do to reduce or to calm the fires of this?
If we had succeeded in Iraq and used the right strategy, you and I would be talking about other things now. It has become a place where Al-Qaeda wants to establish itself. It has become and will become, if we leave, according to a date for withdrawal, a center of Al-Qaeda activities who want to destroy everything we stand for and believe in.
Democrat John Edwards.
China. Because I think China presents huge challenges for America because of their size, because of their population, and because of their not paying attention to human rights, because of their support of dangerous regimes around the world, Sudan, Iran, places that China gets its energy supply. And they're growing their military, and we need to put pressure on them economically, not allow them to continue to manipulate their currency, not allow them to continue to dump dangerous goods on American consumers, which I think they're doing today. I would ratchet up pressure on them diplomatically in terms of what they're doing around the world. I think they're enabling genocide in Sudan, in Darfur.
Republican Mitt Romney.
Iran would probably be at the top of that list. Iran is a nation which speaks of genocide and is rushing headlong to develop weapons that would allow them to carry it out. And that has to be frightening to the entire world. Iran speaks about giving nuclear material to other groups, not just nations, to other groups that would oppose the West. Iran welcomes individuals with bibs that say death to Israel, death to America. At this stage, you dramatically tighten economic and diplomatic sanctions. You make it very tough for Iran to do business around the world.
Democrat Bill Richardson.
The most frightening country in the world is Iran. The way to deal with them is not to threaten them and saber rattle and have military options the way the Bush administration wants to do, but I would talk to them. People talking to each other. I'm a negotiator. I'm a diplomat. I've talked to all the bad people in the world in my life, and the North Koreans, the Cubans, Sudan, and I've succeeded.
Republican Rudy Giuliani.
Iran gives me the greatest concern because Iran is moving toward accomplishing the worst nightmare of the Cold War, nuclear weapons in the hands of an irresponsible regime. And then they're threatening the use of these weapons. This is something unheard of. Even when we go back to the Cold War with the Soviet Union and China, we didn't have these aggressive threats for the use of nuclear weapons, talking about retaliatory use then. And we had mutually assured destruction. And we have an irresponsible regime, a state sponsor of terrorism, that now aggressively wants to become a nuclear power and tells us that they want to destroy Israel and kind of take us over as well. So I think we have to stop them from becoming a nuclear power.
Democrat Joe Biden.
In Pakistan. It is the most complicated relationship we have and the most dangerous. It has nuclear weapons. It not only has the nuclear warhead, it has the missiles. Although they have a majority of moderate middle-class people, there is a significant minority of extreme radical Islamicists. I've been trying to push our economic aid toward building schools in Pakistan. There are 7,000 madrasas, extreme schools built along the Afghan-Pakistani border. We're not doing much for that middle class in Pakistan, dealing with their economic security and their long-term progress.
What country frightens you the most, and what would you do about it as president?
Republican Mike Huckabee.
Probably Iran. And the reason being is that they have a leader right now whose rhetoric is not just inflammatory, but very threatening to Israel, to the rest of the world. Iran has the capacity, because of its oil reserves, if it were to create a serious alliance with Russia and then decide that maybe develop an axis with Venezuela and have that level of control over the oil economy, they could hold the world virtually hostage from both an energy standpoint and an economic standpoint. And it's one of the reasons that we have to accelerate our being completely non-foreign oil dependent. The sooner the better. We need to get to the place where we tell the Saudis, as well as the Iranians, that we need their oil about as much as we need their sand.
10 presidential candidates all answering Katie Couric's question about the scariest country in the world. I'm Howard Arenstein. For Dan Revive, happy holidays and happy new year. Thanks for listening. Join us again next week. We'll be coming to you from Des Moines for the Iowa caucuses.
You've been listening to the CBS News Year-End Roundup. The program is produced in the Washington Bureau of CBS News. The executive producer is Howard Arenstein. This is the CBS Radio Network.